next case of the day, which is In Re Guardianship of Grace. Here's it's Mr. Schill. Good morning to you and Mr. Crampton.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Do either council have any questions before we begin? Mr. Schill, then you may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Heviken, other justices of this court. My name is Andrew Schill. I represent the appellant Deborah Reinhardt in this case. I'd like to preserve 90 seconds of my time for reply. The appellee in this case is Jill Grayson. She's a proposed ward, and this is a guardianship case. This is a case involving a guardian ad litem and the guardian ad litem's report. And the main issue is this. It simply makes no sense that the guardian ad litem was required to submit to the court a report, and then that report is excluded from entering into evidence. It's our position that under the statutes governing the appointment of a guardian ad litem and the duties of a guardian ad litem, the court must most receive the report and the records that the guardian ad litem relied upon in creation of the report.
Counsel, as I understood your argument in brief, the heart of your argument was that Section 30-4204 provided for admission of the guardian ad litem report. Is that a fair characterization?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The text, however, talks about information and itemizes reports from medical providers, providers of psychological services, blah, blah, blah. You understand? And all of those, it seems to me, the legislature was looking to outside sources not involved in the litigation that at least might have a presumption of reliability in the information that they provide. Isn't a guardian ad litem report might have something like that in it, but it also might have a lot of opinions that don't have the indicia of reliability? Is that a fair understanding of that statute?
Your Honor, I guess what I'd say for 4204 is that it specifically applies to the documents that the guardian ad litem relied upon in creation of her report. So as you said, the medical records, police records, that sort of thing.
So the language of the phrase in question is any material obtained by the guardian ad litem.
That's correct.
Not created by the guardian ad litem in his or her report, right? Pursuant to this section is admissible. So the material obtained is admissible. So let's break it out. I think as Judge Castle was suggesting, there's a distinction between the guardian's report and the attachments thereto.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think in this particular case, if we bifurcate the opinions of the guardian ad litem in her report and then the records that she relied upon in forming her opinion, the entire document would be admissible because the guardian ad litem testified to her own report. She testified to her.
Why do the attachments necessarily require that the guardian's impressions, conclusions, suggestion thereby become admissible? Isn't that hearsay?
The guardian testified to her own report. That's why that part of the report is admissible. And then the records that she relied upon are admissible under 4204. So taken in whole, in total, the entire report would be.
You think her testimony makes her report no longer hearsay?
I think her testimony is required by the court under the guardian ad litem statutes. I think 4201 to 4210 is very clear that the guardian ad litem role was specifically expanded in 2016 to provide to the court objective, clear information into the needs of the person who is the subject of the guardian. So part of the duties of the guardian ad litem is to perform that investigation. And again, conceptually, after the guardian ad litem has investigated, gathered all that information and compiled their findings into a report, they have to provide that report to the court. So then, when the guardian ad litem testified to her own report, it makes no sense that the report itself can't come in because 4204 lets the records come in and the report that she was required to do as part of the normal course of business.
But I don't know the legal significance of it makes no sense, but as an evidentiary principle.
I believe evidentiary, the carve-out was for those medical records because when the guardian ad litem statutes were expanded, the particular issue comes up with what do we do about the medical records, because possibly there's a violation of HIPAA, possibly we'd have to subpoena and bring in the providers to testify to their own reports. So it's my understanding, my belief, that when the legislature specifically expanded the role of guardian ad litem, this was their intent, to bring in those records, show the court objectively what the guardian ad litem relied upon, in addition to testifying to her own beliefs, because she's not going to form that report.
Did you get the testimony in through the guardian ad litem that you needed and wanted?
Your Honor, the guardian ad litem testified that she made a report, but she specifically put in the record and in her report itself that I am preparing this report to serve as my own testimony. The report's 63 pages long. And she's not a medical provider, right? She can't testify to a medical condition. So I am preparing this whole thing to serve in lieu of my testimony. And I think in the record itself, she specifically says, I want this report to serve as my testimony. So if the...
Can you cross-examine a report?
You cannot. And
so is that a concern at all?
Absolutely. And I think there's an issue of what the appellee raised in the Confrontation Clause and the Crawford arguments. And I'm happy to address that now. In essence, first, the appellee didn't properly raise that at trial. When the report was offered, the objection was on hearsay and foundational grounds, which I feel is fundamentally different than the due process arguments under the Confrontation Clause. However,
we've already decided it's hearsay, haven't we?
Yeah, and that would specifically be the reason for the 30-4204, the carve-out for the medical records, the hearsay evidence.
That's different than the guardian report, though. Guardian ad litem report.
Yeah, the report in total contained the testimony of the guardian ad litem, which is admissible because she testified to it, and then the records that she relied upon in forming her opinion.
Yeah, again, just testifying doesn't make the report admissible.
She's testifying to her own opinions in
right,
her...
Right, it doesn't make the report admissible, does it?
Well, the report consists simply of her testimony.
It's additional, it's repetitive, but it's not admissible, is it?
I feel that because the court instructed the guardian ad litem to... compile this report, it has to come into evidence, because otherwise what's the point of making the report?
Well, let's say the court disagrees with you, and what do we do then? The trial judge said the report, the written report, and its attachments, which arguably are the material obtained by the guardian, all that went out on hearsay.
What
did the trial judge do wrong?
I would say the trial judge, the harmful error is the exclusion of the report because, again, the guardian ad litem can say that she believes the ward has this medical condition, but she has no basis for that opinion. She has to rely upon those records, and there has to be a clear showing in a guardianship case that guardianship is the least restrictive option and that there's a reason for bringing the guardianship. So if there isn't any medical evidence, then...
Your argument that the statute allows everything to come in, her opinion and the attachments, or does the statute just allow for the attachments to come in?
Yeah, I think specifically the 4204 allows for the attachments to come in so long as they are the medical records, the police records, the financial records.
Counsel, you were the proponent of that piece of evidence consisting of the report and the attachments, correct?
That's correct.
Did you ask the court to receive only the attachments?
I did not. And the reason being, if you read the guardian ad litem report, she specifically includes an affidavit that spells out, I relied specifically on these documents under 4204. I am including them as a part of my report because I believe they're admissible under 4204. If I were to offer the other documents alone, there wouldn't be a basis for that because...
Other than the statute.
The statute, I believe it would be a foundational problem because I could say that these are reports that the guardian ad litem relied upon.
Let me re-ask the question.
Sure.
Did you offer the part of the entirety consisting of the attachments and that portion of the report that was purely foundation?
The offering at the, at the trial level, Your Honor, was the guardian ad litem report in toto.
As in toto?
Yes.
So the trial court was not presented with the opportunity to rule on admissibility of, in essence, the redacted information?
Your Honor, while I agree with that characterization, I would say that the court has language where they say sua sponte that the problem that they see with the report is that it's a double hearsay issue, right? That the guardian ad litem's testifying to something that she read. And again, it's our belief that 4204 allows those documents to come in addition to her argument. I see I have about 20 seconds. I'd like to reserve any time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Crampton, good morning to you.
I was asked to use a microphone.
Do you think that will be of assistance? You don't have to use it if you don't want to.
Oh, I'm okay with it. Apparently, it had to have something to do with the audio visuals, more so than the court not being able to hear me, I hope. At any rate, good morning. I'm James Crampton. I'm here representing the appellee, in this case, the Jill Grayson, the proposed ward or protected person in this case. I want to start off by saying that I view guardianships in the same way that I view criminal cases, in that a person ends up being deprived of their liberty if in fact a guardianship is imposed. And so I look at the statute with regard to admissibility of a guardian ad litem's report, or the, even the attachments that would support the guardian ad litem's opinion, in the same way that I would view double hearsay, double foundation. There are, within that report and within any of those guardian ad litem reports that you would see, there's layers of foundation that go deep, that are going to go from one level of the guardian ad litem's opinion to perhaps a psychiatrist's opinion to perhaps a mother's opinion. The mother's opinion could be tied to the psychiatrist's opinion. All of those things are interrelated. And I think that the whole idea of being able to lay, to have all of those layers come in to evidence, and if in fact that statute actually is designed to put those, all of those foundational levels into evidence without any actual foundation, that is a total denial of due process.
Do you need to attack the constitutionality of the statute?
I'm not even sure I can in this case, because I've never attacked the constitutionality of a statute as an appellee. I don't know.
The court had said, I'm going to overrule the objection, I'm going to allow this material in pursuant to the statute,
then I'd be...
You'd have the ability to preserve that objection, say, Judge, that's unconstitutional.
And I'd be at that table. But
so you have the ability, maybe not in this case, but there are abilities to do so.
Yes. I looked at other things when I was preparing to do the case. I looked at the issues with regard to delegating the court's authority to make ultimate decisions, which that's not argued. That's not assigned as an error in this case, but there were considerations of those kinds of things. And the answer to the ultimate question that you asked there is, does the court need to address the constitutionality? Is the answer to it, I think, is no. I mean, that would be, it's not necessary. And the statute also can be interpreted, from what I have considered, in ways that would make it constitutional. But as far as...
The very basic premise that you talked about, that a guardianship case is akin to a criminal case, and so hearsay and confrontation are especially important. Do you have authority for that?
Well, the Constitution itself, it states that no person would be deprived of their liberty without due process. And that, I mean, it's hard to get more direct than the Constitution of the state of Nebraska as far as a constitutional issue. Ultimately, an order that's entered that enters a guardianship and appoints a person a guardian deprives that person of their liberty until further order of court. Now, it's not the same as a criminal conviction because the burden of proof, if you want to eliminate a guardianship in the future, the burden of proof remains on the guardian as opposed to on the incapacitated or the determined to be incapacitated person. But I'm asking that the court affirm the decision. And when it comes down to, like, does the court need to rule upon the constitutionality of the statute in order to affirm the decision? No. But I think it's something that should be appropriately considered by the court because there's guardianship proceedings that are held every day in courts all over the state. And the statute that was passed was the intention, apparently, of the legislature to make it easier for a guardian ad litem's foundational materials as well as their opinion to go into evidence without having the underlying levels of the basis for those facts, those opinions, whatever is stated in those particular documents.
I beg your pardon, because earlier you said something about you explored maybe not relying upon a delegation problem. Sure what you meant. Is that by saying that the legislature has created a rule of evidence?
It's exactly what the legislature has done with this. If, in fact, it's the intention of that statute to say that a guardian ad litem can perform their investigation, take every document they see, write up a report that says all of the things that they have as far as their opinions, and hand it into the court, and there's no cross-examination, there's no need for the guardian ad litem to appear for court because the report goes into evidence, and that is something that the county court can then rely upon according to the legislature.
And don't we say that in Nebraska, at least, that the rules of evidence are the prerogative of the legislature largely?
Yes.
In 27802, the legislature has said hearsay not admissible, blah, 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 except by rules adopted by statute. This may be one such a thing. And actually, we have said hearsay's out unless by rules, and we have said rules encompasses statutes. So now we got a statute that seems to say it's in.
Isn't part of your argument, though, that 30-4205, which deals with the report of the guardian ad litem, does not have language that makes that report per se admissible in evidence?
That's correct. And by the way, the analysis in your first question was impressive to me. I think you have it exactly figured out. There is a division there between the guardian ad litem's statements and the basis for those statements as far as I think the intention would be that they were trying to make trial procedures a lot shorter by not having to have a lot of people come in to testify. And the complaint that I have, or Jill Grayson has, with regard to the procedure that is being proposed by the appellant in this case, is that she'd be deprived of her liberty without ever having had an opportunity to.
As to how this case actually came down, my suggestion has been that the court has ruled the report and also the attachments are hearsay. And those are two separate items, correct?
Correct.
What do we do with that ruling?
Affirm.
Well,
thought you'd say that.
to be precise, however, they were offered in the form of a single exhibit, correct?
Yes.
So.
But at one point the judge said, well, maybe we could bust them out, and you were not interested in that either.
Well, I mean, I was representing the proposal.
Well, that's advocacy, and I respect it. I'm trying to just revisit the record.
What can the court consider the report that's submitted to it a week prior to the hearing date pursuant to 3040205 for? What, is it just background, under your understanding?
It's almost like a pretrial brief. But
anything that, in your view, the opinions that are expressed or the documents that are relied upon, even though it's provided to the court, the proponent would still have, the onus would still be on the proponent to separately get those admitted into evidence at the hearing.
Frequently, when trial courts are looking at opinions of guardian ad litem or of expert witnesses, the court will oftentimes be more interested in the basis for those opinions than in the actual opinion. And I don't think the court should be deprived of the information regarding the basis of the opinions. And that goes on the opinion of the guardian ad litem. It goes on the opinion of anybody that the guardian ad litem relies upon.
Well, to complicate matters, perhaps, and this has been in the brief, in 3026.19.04, it says the petitioner and the proposed ward should have 10 days to file a response to a visitor's evaluation, but the visitor's not the guardian ad litem, so I'm not sure that's on the table, literally.
Right. There was no visitor in
right.
This case.
And then we have our rule 6-1433.01F. The office public guardian shall have 10 days to object to the visitor or the guardian's report. So then the office of the public guardian could have objected to the public guardian could have objected to the guardian ad litem's report. But your client was not included in that.
She's not, I mean, there's nothing with regard to anybody else.
So hearkening back to Justice Papik's question, the report is there and some people can object to it, not everybody, and evidently under the statute.
Doesn't hardly seem fair, does it?
I'm trying to synthesize them. I agree that it's a challenge.
Does the judge get to read a report that is submitted to the judge at least a week before?
We have long been able to rely upon trial court judges to hear evidence that is not admissible and not considerate in making opinions. Anything else?
Thank you for holding the microphone. That really was for the benefit of the people watching on the streaming across the state of Nebraska. So people who could not be here could actually hear what you had to say, and we appreciate your doing that.
Sure. I'll bring a lapel mic next time I've got one.
We could do that too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 15 seconds.
Mr. Schill, we will give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, in response to the appellee's argument, I think the court said it exactly right. there isn't a constitutional issue here because it wasn't properly raised by the appellee at court. He didn't argue due process, so you can't bring it up now. However, to the court's question about whether the ward properly had notice to object to the report, I think the court should look to 4205 that specifically says that the report is provided to the two parties at least a week prior to the hearing date, and a copy of that report shall be provided to all interested persons. Interested persons includes the ward.
But you would concede that section that you're quoting from does not, by its terms, make that report admissible in evidence as the previous section did for underlying material.
I would argue that, again, the point of introducing the guardian ad litem statutes, the reformation of the guardian ad litem statutes, is to get that report into evidence. That's why the guardian ad litem testifies to it, or as Appley correctly notes, the guardian ad litem could submit the report to the court and then never testify to it. It would actually come into evidence. To the court's question on the 10-day response for the Office of Public Guardian, in the same 6-4143301, the nomination statutes, the court can appoint a visitor or a guardian ad litem, and they have a dual role. They're supposed to, whether the court appoints a visitor or whether they appoint a guardian ad litem, they're supposed to perform an investigation and provide that report to the court. Now, specifically, in E, it says the visitor or the guardian ad litem report shall comply with the statutes, and then F, the Office of Guardian shall have 10 judicial days to respond to the visitor or the guardian ad litem report. So I guess I view the roles of the visitor and the roles of the guardian ad litem to be exactly the same in this case. I see that I'm out of time. I appreciate the court, and I submit to my brief.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Counsel, that concludes arguments in re guardianship of Grayson and arguments for the day. So the court is adjourned, and you are excused.